You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. Living on Gumbunya country in Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Sandy. My guest this week on Talk the Walk is Alana Ordis. Like many of us that start out in remote social work, Alana was enticed away from the big city lights of Sydney to the beauty of Central Australia. With no manager at the time and just a couple of handbooks under her arm, Alana immersed herself in getting to know the landscapes and the people. She works partly as a generalist counsellor and the other part in the Victims of Crime program with Catholic Care NT. Alana is treading her own autonomous path, responding to the needs of the community wherever this presents, from her office in Alice Springs to the prison, where Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples far outnumber the rest of the prison population. Still in the midst of finding her feet, I'm really looking forward to finding out how Alana has survived and thrived in the first 12 months of her journey into remote social work. Alana, thanks for taking the time to talk the walk with me today.
Thanks, Lucy.
Alana, can you describe that moment when you thought, yep, I'm going to pack up everything in my Sydney life and head to the outback? And what was it that was leading you to this decision?
It was in my second year of a social work degree that I actually came up to Alice Springs. And I remember walking around the town and getting the sense that Alice is a really special community. And so it wasn't until, I guess I held that in my heart, but it wasn't until I started to get to the end of my degree that I really realised that, you know, I was going to leave Sydney and Alice would be the place I'd go to.
So had you been to Alice Springs before? And yeah, what was that like?
Yeah.
When your first impressions?
Yeah. So I came up to Alice in 2014, and it was actually to do an Uluru trip. So started off at Uluru and then on the journey back came through Alice Springs, and I think I had about 5 days here. And whenever I'm in community, I always look around on notice boards and just try and get a sense of, you know, the community spirit here. And I could see that as a tourist, I wasn't going to have access into the community, but I could see that there was a really, really rich community here, just from looking at the people and the events and some kind of closeness that I wanted to be a part of.
So did you have any prior experience working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people before you rocked up to Alice Springs?
No, I started here as a complete beginner. So it's really been a learning journey for me. Working in Sydney, I was living and working within culturally diverse communities, but not really specifically working with Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people.
Do you think that some of your exposure to, I guess, people from other cultures really helped you with working towards working with Aboriginal people and communities?
Yeah, definitely. I've always lived in culturally diverse communities in Sydney. So I actually grew up in quite a white community, and I left once I hit 18. And so from that point onwards, I've always lived in culturally diverse communities. And I think I'd really struggle to go back to living in, yeah, just white communities. It feels like there's something really missing. So having that experience and that exposure helped. But at the same time, I'd say it's completely different. You know, maybe coming into it with an open mind, but I think for the culture, they're not the same. You know, there's so much to learn.
Even Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities living in Sydney would be vastly different, I imagine, from those out in the desert.
When I first came to Alice Springs, I didn't even know what a town camp was. So
the learning curve has been huge over the last 12 months.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So tell me about this drive or passion, because it sounds like you're really enjoying your time there and wouldn't consider going back. So where does this drive or passion come from the work that you're doing now?
I would say the drive for social work comes from a place of social justice, and that drive, the very seed of my drive and my passion, stems from my own lived experience of being a young person and accessing a youth service myself. So my first entry into social work was actually as a client, not as a social worker.
When you think about that time accessing that youth service, I imagine there was some particular workers that you came across and connected with that you could see, I don't know, a way forward for yourself into this kind of work. Is that what happened?
Mm. Yeah, because at that time, so I just moved from a smaller city in New South Wales up to Sydney, and I was just 18, so moving up to a big city. I'd never lived out of home before. I had so much to learn, and my caseworker was a real role model and mentor to me. I think she was able to see strengths in me that I couldn't see in myself, and at the time things with mum and dad were difficult, so definitely things that mum and dad couldn't see in me either. And watching her advocate for me, and I'll actually remember a time when she wrote a letter to me acknowledging all of my achievements. And you know, these achievements are things that people take for granted, like having somewhere to live, going to a job interview, doing little things. But at the time, those little things were really, really big things for me. Mm. And I really needed the support. So I just watched her. I remember watching her ringing up different organisations and, you know, advocating for me and making referrals. And she really taught me a lot about social work, because I was then able to go on and do those things for myself and show other people too. So I picked up a lot of little things along the way before I even got into the social work sector, just from, you know, I guess being broke or having debts and needing to ring up certain hotlines or access food. So that was, yeah, that was a real lived experience and journey of coming into social work. And I carry that with me every day when I work with my clients.
It sounds like a real turning point for you
and
mm-hmm. your link to this value of social justice, as you say.
Yeah.
So what does it mean to you to live out the value of social justice with Aboriginal people and communities that you're working with? What does that look like for you?
I think living in Central Australia has, as you know, I'm a white woman living in Central Australia, and there's a lot about it that's, you know, that can be problematic, because we're here and we're working in sort of the big social services sort of complex, industrial complex. You know, it's really intense. But what it means to me is facing up to colonization. Living and working in Central Australia means that I can't run and hide. I could move back to Sydney, but I know what I know. And so it's about going about it in two ways, acknowledging people's strengths and knowledges that I don't have. You know, this is a way of living and being and a culture that has nothing to do with me. So it's not my job to impose my views onto somebody else. It's actually my job to sit down and listen. And it's also about, I think, really understanding as well the deep complexity of poverty and people who've been displaced from their culture, and like really looking at how systemic the issue actually is. So it's two ways. I don't really want to go on, I think sometimes white people talk way too much about Aboriginal people's struggle stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that creates a really heavy sort of narrative, and it's not our stories to keep on telling. You know, we're sort of shaping people's lives through these stories. So I think I'm still learning every single day, but for now I think my role is to be really guided by the person that I'm sitting with, given that I don't know. You know, I really don't know.
So I'm wondering if you can give us a little bit of a picture on what it's like to be a fly on the wall when you're speaking with someone, you're shaping people's lives through story. I know that narrative therapy practice is really important to you. What would that look like if we were a little fly on the wall watching you?
Well, I think sometimes I get into some pretty kooky conversations with people because narrative practice is really about externalizing and naming, you know, naming different elements. So it could be, we could be talking about some really funny metaphors that, or like, you know, the big grey blob and how the big grey blob might be affecting somebody's life. Things that you're not going to find in a sort of social work or psychology textbook. And some of the interventions that I've started working with since undertaking the narrative therapy training have been really unique. So looking at, you know, document making, so I've been writing letters to my clients and recently put together an award, like an acknowledgement award for one of my clients. And so I think it's really working together. It's really shifted my way of working with clients. So it feels a lot more collaborative. Yeah. If you were a fly on the wall, you would be maybe thinking there's some pretty quirky conversations going on.
What difference do you think it's making to the lives of the people that you're working with to have these conversations that are focusing on their strengths and skills and knowledge and not so much on the problem story of their lives? What difference does it make to them, do you think?
I think it's helping people to realise that the knowledge is actually centralised, like it's inside of themselves, but because the problem stories have been going on for so long, or people have been taught to trust health professionals or trust other people that aren't themselves, it's actually about going back to the beginning. And when I started working as a counsellor, I was using some techniques that are more, I guess they're kind of more frameworks that you put onto people, you know, they're sort of skills and tactics that you get people to learn, and that's the method. And I had a client say to me, you know, I just don't want to learn any more tools. I'm done with the tools. And so we had a really good chat about where we were at and what they needed. And so the funny thing was, we put all of that aside, and thankfully I just trained in narrative therapy. I'd just come back from the course. So we sort of said, all right, well, why don't we, you know, give this a go instead? And then maybe sort of 4-5 sessions later, she said to me, I've got the tools now. So the tools actually came, but they didn't come through me as a therapist, you know, sort of walking her through this almost recipe-like way of approaching things. It was like we found out what her tools were, and they were the tools that she was waiting to receive, not my tools, not anybody else's tools. And it was her language as well. So I think that's a lot more powerful. It's kind of like the inside-out approach.
It really goes back to clients being the expert in their own lives, doesn't it?
That's right. Yeah, I think so. But I think even though that's what we're taught from the day one, if you actually look at a lot of the therapy models, you'll see that by having particular structures, and, you know, these structures work, like, for example, CBT can be great, but we're still sort of imposing something onto somebody. And I think that's what narrative therapy really moves away from. It's really looking at what the person already knows and, you know, pulling out those strong stories. So that's what I'm really enjoying at the moment.
Fantastic. Can you speak a bit more about, I guess, the values or principles underlying narrative therapy? I'm really liking what I'm hearing in your approach, the way that you shape people's lives through story, not through tools and assessment models that come from outside that we're imposing on other people. Yeah, and I'm interested in exploring what are the values and principles behind that that you really connect with, that speaks to you about this is the way I want to work.
I think the most important value that I have in my therapy practice is relationships. So I value sort of my client relationships very highly. And I guess from I can only go from the feedback that I've received and how I feel as a therapist. It's always tricky to gauge, but the sense of having strong relationships with clients, and if you really value someone and you place the relationship highly, then it's about walking with that person. And also, as a new professional, the reality is that sometimes I just don't know. And there's two ways that you can go about not knowing. You can try to pretend that you know, and even though you don't know, and, you know, maybe you'll be sort of confronted with a situation or a client problem that you've never dealt with before, and you can go online and you can research about it, which I've certainly done in the past. And then the narrative approach, which I've been finding really helpful, is just talking to your client and asking them how they might like to unpack a certain issue, what would feel good for them. You know, there's so many different ways we can express ourselves. So, for example, working with sexual abuse, that's a really, really big topic. And having somebody tell their story, it might not be what they're looking for. Maybe they've told this story many times. Maybe they want to write a letter from a certain age in their life. Maybe they want to make a piece of art about it. But I think it's about being right there with the client and meeting them at the point that they're at. So it's okay not to know. Just don't pretend that you – just don't try and sort of, you know, pretend that you know and then sort of disrespect the person. Just you've got to be true to yourself and true to your clients.
As you were speaking, I was thinking about this skill of intuition that's so strong in that present moment when you're with someone. Because often we could just go back into a bit of panic about, oh, I need to bring out this tool right now because I'm feeling like I don't know how to deal with this situation. But it's just about being present, isn't it? And being guided by that intuitive knowledge and just coming back to that strong sense of, you know, I'm here to develop a relationship with this person and how can I do that most respectfully?
Definitely, Lucy. That's how I felt a lot with working with complex trauma cases, because working in Central Australia is like nothing else. You really go straight into the deep end. And there have been times where I've been, you know, I've been treading water. I'm not sort of always sure what I'm doing, but I've come back to that point. And it's something I've been reflecting on a lot lately around really, especially with complex trauma, I think honouring people's processes and their own personal processes, because you've got to be really careful. Like, you could have somebody tell their story and open up to you and it be a really re-traumatizing experience. So I think the nice thing about narrative therapy is you're handing the power back and you're saying, what do you want to do? I'm going to be here with you every step of the way. I'm going to journey with you. But how do you want to do this? What feels right for you? If we get to a certain point and it's too much, then we stop. It's not about me. It's not about my process. It's not my story to tell. It's that person's story to tell. So it's really being guided by the client.
Another thing that springs to mind from narrative therapy is this idea of being decentered but influential. Is that something that resonates with you in your practice? And what does that look like?
Yeah, it does. It does. It's been interesting because before I left New South Wales, I trained in acceptance and commitment therapy, which I still really love. And I've had some great success stories with it. But I would say that it's quite different from narrative practice. So for the first half of the year, I was using acceptance and commitment therapy with most of my clients because I've just really wanted to focus on, you know, putting my skills, like not learning too many different styles of therapy at once, but I just sort of thought, okay, I'll look at narrative therapy, and I'll look at acceptance and commitment therapy this year. So I would say acceptance and commitment therapy is a bit more centered, or being like sort of driving the therapy session.
Mm-hmm.
So I really had to switch gears because that's what I was using a lot in the very beginning. And I still will keep using it because I've had some really positive experiences with it. Mm-hmm. And like my clients have reported that they've enjoyed it. But I think, I'm on a learning journey with narrative therapy at the moment. So I feel like I've just kind of changed lanes and I'm seeing where it takes me.
The idea of being more in a decentered but influential place fits for you by the sounds of it.
It does. it does, because I think we're having more interesting conversations. I'm just loving some of the metaphors and things that were being named. They're really, really rich conversations that we wouldn't be having otherwise.
I love metaphors and working with metaphors, as you might know. Can you think of one recently that was really interesting?
Yeah, so working with somebody and he was talking about his love for cooking, and I won't give away too many details, but basically he was sort of talking about this persona of being chef, and I asked him, so what does that mean to you? And then we sort of got onto the idea of how he's creating a recipe book at the moment, and sometimes you've only got three ingredients, and from three ingredients you make a meal. Mm-hmm. And so we got into this really beautiful metaphor about how being chef is a person that he can, like an identity that mm-hmm. he can take on, that helps him feel cool and confident and relaxed. And when he embodies chef,
mm-hmm.
He's able to really take three ingredients and make a meal. And just the ideas of how sometimes in life we might feel like we've only got three ingredients, and we're going to make a meal out of it, and looking at what those three ingredients are. So we started to really explore this idea, and then we were putting together a recipe. And that recipe included, you know, love and friendship. And we haven't worked out what the method is yet, but we'll get there eventually. So
these kinds of conversations are really ones that are going to stick with people, aren't they? They're not the kind of conversations we normally have.
No.
And I can imagine that in the future, this client is going to really remember his recipe for living.
Yes.
And you mentioned before about documentation, letter writing, and that sort of thing. Are you using that to help clients then take this recipe or whatever it is that you're developing with them in a visual form?
Yeah, this is something I'm interested in at the moment, documentation as a way that we can preserve and honour stories, particularly strong stories. So one project a client and I are just about to start is creating a book. And it will be her book, where we can write down. So this book will be for her to look at when she's going through hard times. It's a way that we can preserve her strong stories and her achievements.
Mm.
And then also it will have little reminders for her what she knows about her own mind. So the sort of folk psychology that we've pulled out, her local knowledge about herself. And we've been really looking at processes of acknowledgement and achievement, and thinking a lot about how, you know, it's tricky when we're doing healing work, because maybe our friends and family, they may notice changes, but then there are often parts of our stories that go completely unnoticed and unacknowledged. And so looking at how we can really name strengths and draw out strong stories and write them down and preserve them.
Mm.
So that they can be honoured from here right into the future.
With the documents that you've written so far with some of your clients, what does it mean to them to be able to have this in their hands and take it with them? What have you noticed?
For my clients, it's an extension of our therapy session. So I'll ask for permission to write to a client. And then I'll usually send the letter between our session, and it'll have direct quotes from language that they've used in session. I've received positive feedback from one of my clients. She said that it really helped her, and she read over the letter several times after receiving it. What I hope it'll do will be a way to, I guess, further honour the client, and I'd like them to have a sense that I really am listening, that I'm going the extra step, that every relationship that is formed in my counselling space is important, and each client that I come in contact with is unique and important to me. Yeah, and that's a way that I can honour that process and show them that I'm walking beside them.
So I'd like to go back to some words that you said before. I think you said you felt like you were treading water or being in the deep end, perhaps when you first arrived in Alice Springs, to explore, I guess, some of the challenges or struggles that you've faced along the way. Obviously, it hasn't been easy and you're still on this learning journey, like you say. So, yeah, can you share, I guess, some of the challenges that you found initially when you arrived and really trying to make yourself known, I guess?
Wow, there's been quite a lot of hurdles along the way, but I think one of the challenges of working in Central Australia is that we NT-wide, there's a recruitment issue. So there's a lot of turnover of staff, which means at times you could be working in a team and then you might have people come and people go. You might find yourself working alone, as I am right now, while we're waiting for more staff to come on board. When I started my job, they were actually in the process of recruiting a manager. So it was so different from how I imagined myself starting my social work career when I was back in Sydney. You know, I thought that I'd be coming into a role where I'd have a superior who would be guiding me and telling me sort of showing me how to do the job, and really, you know, just it's been a very, very autonomous journey, and I think it takes a certain kind of person to be able to go with it. I think you have to be quite resilient, and I think my own personal life has taught me a lot of emotional resilience, which I draw on every day in this job, because it can be quite a lonely journey at times. And you know, working as a therapist means that you get home and your loved ones have no idea what you've just been through in a day. And maybe you've got children to care for or animals to care for, or, you know, other responsibilities. And I think too, I want to talk about the process of not only providing therapy, but the secondary experience of being in therapy. So I think something that I didn't expect was what a huge personal journey that would take me on. So I'm in therapy every day, not only with my clients, but with myself. So I think that makes, you know, it can make you feel a bit nutty sometimes, but also I've grown a lot along the way, and I've probably feel like I've achieved more personal growth in this 1 year here in Alice Springs than I had in many, many, many years in Sydney. So
what do you think helped you to work through some of these challenges? Because doing therapy on yourself is not an easy thing, especially when you don't have maybe supervision that's available just when you want it. Yeah, what are some of the things that got you through or are getting you through?
I've got a really beautiful community of friends around me here in Alice Springs, and that's one of the reasons why I will stay here and I'll continue to work and live in Alice Springs, because the richness of the people, such a gift to have close relationships with people, you know, within such a gorgeous environment we've got. I think that's what balances it out, because Alice is such a raw place, and it's the softness of the people and the nature that enables me to keep on doing this really high intensity social work. Yeah, I don't think I could do this in Sydney. I think it would be too hard. I think there's just, there'd be too many elements of it that would be just too hard. But here it's small and it's intense, but also the community is gentle and the nature is gentle.
So how much does the environment around you play in nurturing you? I know the gorgeous ranges and just flying into that community, there's a sense of peace and calmness against the rawness as well. So how much does nature and the physical environment impact on your well-being and maintaining your self-care, I guess?
Yeah, I feel like it's a deeply very, this whole experience here, it's very psychodynamic from the therapy room to the nature that I, that nature stares at me and I stare back. And so I feel like I'm in a relationship with this whole place. but being here in nature, it really helps me. There are times where I can feel that the emotional fatigue is starting to creep up on me. And when it gets to that point, I usually go bush. I'll go bush for a night or two just to let go and calm the mind. And you know, the ease of being able to chuck a swag in the back of your car and drive out to, you know, maybe you only drive 20 minutes. You drive out, roll out a swag, you light a fire and look up at the stars, and you know that whatever kind of week you've had, it's going to be okay. You just reset yourself and you can be back home sort of the next day, the next morning if you want. It doesn't have to be a hassle, but you know that it's always there for you. It's there to hold you.
And do clients speak about this connection in the way that you're speaking about it, in a nurturing and calm way? Is 'cause I find that connection to place is really important for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and it's part of their identity. It's who they are. Are you finding that in the environment and nature is part of your conversations with them?
Yeah, I'm finding that, you know, clients will often make reference to, you know, going bush or going back to country when things are hard or there's tough times that they're experiencing, and that plays an important role in their healing process. Or clients will talk about, you know, sleeping in the sun and what that does for the body. Maybe when the mind is experiencing hardship, that just being in nature and taking a deep rest sort of under a tree, how healing that can be.
Gorgeous. It's no surprise that you're experiencing the benefits of being in nature too, is it? Isn't it?
No.
I think as human beings, it's where we've come from and it's where we belong and it's where we need to get back to sometimes when we're stressed. When you were talking before about the impact that youth worker had in your life when you were a part of the youth service, accessing some services in Sydney, and you talked about this idea of resilience and that worker helping you realise the strengths that you had and highlighting those to you. And I wondered whether, yeah, this idea of resilience that you talked about with your clients is something that you could relate to in that experience of working with the youth worker.
Yeah, you are to a degree. I think what I could say as a broad sweeping statement without getting into things is, you know, I'm somebody who's experienced depression myself, and so that lived experience has helped me see two ways. So I have two ways of seeing, and often I share the role of, there'll be issues that will arise. Maybe it's something a client is experiencing and I might have insider knowledge into that. Now, my client might not know, my client won't know that, but I'll know that. And so I can put my social work hat on, and I can also come at that from a place of having insider knowledge. Sometimes when we're talking about resilience or getting through tough times, because sometimes this work comes the way that it comes at you, it can be really strong and it can feel like it's something you're getting through depending on where you're at the process.
How influential was it to have a youth worker
recognize those strengths and knowledge in you, and you experience for yourself that sense of resilience, what influence has that had on how you approach your work with other people? Is there a sense of resilience exists in everybody? Because it's very easy to throw that word around sometimes, and people have different interpretations of what resilience means. So maybe I'm trying to explore a bit further about what does resilience mean to you, and is that meaning that you have connected in some way to your experience as a person who's had depression and reached out and got help?
Resilience to me is getting through tough times, very simply put. And we all have our own ways of getting through tough times, and that experience with a youth worker was over a decade ago now, so I guess I really have to sit with that and think about it. But yes, I would say that she did influence my view of myself and my own personal resilience. Perhaps that was the very beginning. And with clients, you know, I think resilience, you hear the word so often, and I think resilience, it is a positive thing, but also sometimes having to be resilient sucks. It often means that you've been through a really, really tough time, or like needing to really draw on resilience. Needing to be too resilient can maybe be a sign that a lot of trauma has happened. So I think understanding that we all come from a different place, we don't have the same starting point, you know, our experience with resilience is very diverse, and so people find ways to resist and be resilient in their own way. And if they've been through particularly hard times, like some of my clients are survivors of long-standing domestic violence, they have come from a place where a lot of emotional and psychological abuse has happened, and so even the process of learning how to resist and stand up is a part of that healing journey of self-worth and self-esteem, because they've been pushed down, you know, for a long time. So just meeting that person where they're at and finding out what they've done to get through their tough times.
We've talked a lot about the influence this youth worker has had on your life. I'm wondering if there are other role models. If you were to think about, I guess, the people that have shaped your practice, who do you think those people might be?
Definitely my time at university really shaped me. I went to a university in Sydney that's quite multicultural and diverse, and quite a lot of the students there, you know, they may be the first in their family to go to university, like lovingly think of it as like the underdog university. And it was just such a great experience, because I found that we were very supported and treated with a lot of respect. And I looked to my teachers and the lecturers and the experiences that they had, really appreciated their stories. It helped me prepare for social work, and I think I really enjoyed being at university, and I had a lot of opportunity as well. I was quite like academically focused at the time, so I feel like I received a lot of support and mentoring. But I think really, just to come back to my work being relational, I would have to say, you know, it's the rich relationships that I have with my friends and my family, and they give me time and they listen. And I'm sure sometimes they probably think that, you know, I'm really cuckoo or maybe a bit intense, but gee, they have no idea what kind of day I've had. But they listen and they give me space and they, you know, they nurture me, and that gives me the energy to nurture my clients.
Is there one particular person that comes to mind when you think about someone who really listens to you and gives you space?
I think I'd get in trouble if I picked just one.
Or what about one of those lecturers in university that you think wouldn't be surprised to hear about where you've ended up and the kind of work that you're doing? Who would that be?
I connected a lot with some of the feminist social work staff, and at the start of the year I actually gave a lecture on LGBTIQ domestic violence. So I think some of the staff there are quite aware that I'm quite driven when it comes to social work, and I had the opportunity to pursue honours, which I was going to do. It wasn't the right time for me, but I think there was a sense, it was recognised within the university that there was that I could go ahead and do that if I wanted to. So I'm thinking, I won't name names, but I am thinking of, you know, a few staff who really supported me and very positive, you know, lots of positive words about my practice and my social work or what would become my practice. So
can you think of some particular words that they might use to describe this practice? You already mentioned that they would say you're quite driven. What other words they might use to describe you and the way you approach your work?
Well, I think, Lucy, it's got to do with probably my politics. So before I started uni, I've been reading a lot of literature around sort of, you know, feminism and race politics, and that's an interest to me. So a social work is kind of an extension of my own radical politics. Mm-hmm. So I think when I was at uni, like, they were teaching us what felt like the 101 to me. So I was already like, yeah, so it came quite naturally to me, and I was able to contribute to the discussion. I don't think they would be surprised, because I worked really, really hard for my social work degree. I went into university with, you know, with a 2-year-old, mm-hmm. so as a single parent. So I've worked really, really hard to get to the place that I'm at. I think with social work, I'm not afraid to break some rules. Like, sometimes, you know, as workers, we've really got to think, we've really got to question certain processes and how much it's of the interest of the organisation and how much it's of the interest of the client. And so I could never be in a kind of role where I was really, really restricted, because it would bump up too much against my personal politics and I wouldn't be able to go on. So I'm a social worker, I'm not a robot.
So if this group of feminist staff at the university were kind of listening to this conversation now, what do you think they would say about the ways that you've been able to enter very respectfully a new community and work so closely and gently with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people? What sort of words do you think they would tell us listening now?
I think they would feel proud, because they would feel as if their teaching has had an impact, and I think they would say that that it hasn't surprised them that I've made these decisions, because they watched me grow and really supported me. And we did a really big project on the intervention. So for us, social work, it was something along the lines of like social work, policy and practice. We watched John Pilger's documentary Utopia, which I'd already seen, but it was really good to go back and revisit that and have a look at bottom-up approaches to policy, and then just, you know, heavily reflect on the impact of the intervention.
So given your insights back then in the university context about the intervention, and now that you're out in the Northern Territory seeing the impacts of that, what have you noticed?
Look, I've noticed that the damage that's been caused by the intervention and by, you know, the stolen generation, and also what we continue to do. I mean, at the moment, the prisons are filled with Indigenous people, that we have caused so much damage, so much damage. And I struggle to make sense of, you know, people talk about answers. Well, what does that mean? But I think it's about we need to hand the power back. We have caused so much damage, and living in Central Australia, the levels of domestic violence and drug and alcohol abuse, because people have been taken away from their land and their culture and they're hurting. I think our role as social workers when working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people is to facilitate ways that we can hand the power back, whether that be through community development approaches to mental health, or always whenever there can possibly be, Indigenous people need to be running and leading projects. I think, yeah, we have done too much damage, and now it's time to step away and hand the power back.
What I've been hearing this morning in our conversation is you're really handing the power back, even if you're only just speaking with one person, in the way that you hold them in that space and conduct that conversation. We can do a lot to give them the power.
Yeah, yep.
I'm realising that we're coming to the end of our time, but I'd love to just finish on a couple of things. Thinking back over the last 12 months, what would you say has been your biggest learning? Just following on from that, what kind of advice would you give other social workers that might be considering entering a remote community and working?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question, Lucy. So what I would say is, if you are in a position where maybe you're living in a city at the moment and you're struggling to find work and you've got an interest in working remotely, give it a try. I've relocated here. I've set up a completely brand new life. And what I would say is, don't be afraid to come up here and have a chat with different organisations. So you don't necessarily need to have a job before you move. Alice is one of those places where people do come and go, and it's really nice to get a sense of what kind of work the different organisations are doing and have an understanding of management structures and, you know, staff members. So don't be scared to come up here. Maybe come up here for a holiday, check it out and see if you can do a little bit of door knocking. Ask questions, because people are really friendly here and it's good to have a sense of the different organisations first, I would say, before you start applying for jobs. And the work here is really intense. It's not always about the number of clients that you have. Sometimes it's about the level of complex trauma that you're dealing with. So it's taken me all year to realise with the clients that we're working with, because sometimes their needs are really high, it means that you can't maybe take on as many clients as you usually would if you were working in different contexts. The work does affect you. You've got to be very proactive about looking after yourself, and that's different for everybody. It could be a yoga practice or taking your dog for a walk, but it's for the longevity of social work. You really, really need to get real about it. Otherwise, you will burn out. Yeah.
That's awesome advice, because like you said earlier, turnover of staff is a huge issue, and that doesn't do anyone any favours, particularly people that have welcomed you into their community. And if you're just the next person that comes and turns around and heads off again, yeah, you can actually do some damage that way. So I think what you're saying in terms of really thinking about moving to a place and checking it out first is so great.
Yes.
Because it's a big commitment, isn't it?
It is a really big commitment, and we've got quite a few Aboriginal corporations here. And, you know, I think the work they're doing, it's really amazing. And, you know, go and have a chat with different people, find out what's going on, find out if it's something you'd like to be a part of. But it's an experience that will change you for the rest of your life. And I think once the dust gets under your skin, there's no turning back.
I think that's a perfect place to finish, unless you have one little sparkling moment you'd like to share, maybe in your last week, something that just really made your heart sing. What can you share?
Recently, I had a client come in and we'd been having this fantastic, another sort of quirky narrative therapy metaphor around a donut. Anyway, I won't sort of go too far into that, but She brought a little macaroon, one for her and one for I, into the therapy session, and that was just symbolic of the work that we've been doing together. It was a place for us to celebrate.
Oh, how gorgeous. Thank you so much, Valana, for, yeah, shedding some light on what the journey's been like for you over the last 12 months. I really look forward to staying in touch and hearing what the next 12 months is like, and maybe we can come back again then and have another chat to see what those learnings have been.
That sounds great, Lucy. Thank you.
How can people contact you, maybe if they'd like to follow up with you or just find out a bit more about Alice Springs? Is there some way that they can get in touch?
Yeah, I will. I'll provide my my personal emails. Feel free to email me if you've got any questions about social work or moving to Alice Springs, and hopefully I can come up with some answers.
Beautiful. Thank you so much again, and all the best.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. Music by Flashback Digital. You can access all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphorically-speaking.com.au. I'm currently on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. If you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphorically-speaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.